Hey, Sam, how you doing?
Good. How's it going?
It's going well. Did you have a nice Father's Day?
I did. You?
We don't really do anything. I don't even know how to celebrate.
You don't observe?
We don't observe. I feel like every day is Father's Day in my house.
I got one card. I've got two daughters, one card. So it was sweet.
That's better than I got. All right. Yeah. Well, let me set the series up. All right. Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of More From Sam. As a reminder, the goal of the series is to get more from Sam on current events more often, and also to share a more fun side of Sam. Sam, you have a fun side. Plenty of heavy shit to discuss, but in this series, we're allowed to have fun doing it. The tone is faster paced, which includes interruptions because they create more energy. I'm here to surface Sam's ideas, so don't get caught up on what you think my actual positions might be. It doesn't matter. Everybody loves a spicy Sam, so I'm going to do what I can to get more of that. And lastly, this series is not meant to be. Thank you. It's not meant to be a replacement for anything. It's simply in addition to what Sam is already doing. Also, Sam has some tour dates coming up this fall that have already been announced. New York and Boston in October are nearly sold out. I think there are about 100 tickets last I checked in each of those cities. Mm-hmm. And Seattle, and nice job, Sam. Well done. Thanks to all those in New York and Boston who have quickly bought tickets. And Seattle and San Jose in September are each a little over 50% sold as well. So if you want tickets to any of those shows, you can head over to samharris.org. Also, we're about to announce Chicago. So that's coming this week. In order to get, it should be fun. In order to get access to the presale, you must be a paid subscriber to the podcast, and then there'll be a general on sale shortly thereafter. Anyway, all this info can be found on the website. And if you're on the mailing list, be on the lookout for something coming very soon. Sam, are there any quick thoughts on these shows you can share with us? Something the audience should...
Just that I'm looking forward to them. I'm going to write a talk, and so the first hour will not be extemporaneous. Maybe I'll say something. There'll be some marginalia as I work from what I've prepared. But no, I'm actually going into this wanting to put my thoughts in order, and I love the excuse to be able to do that. So it feels almost like I have to write a short book between now and then. But I will do that, and I'll come prepared to tell people what I'm thinking about.
Well, that'll be fun. And then the second half, we'll do an episode of More From Sam, this kind of vibe where we can incorporate some of the current events.
I mean, I think what I want to do is I want to field the questions in advance that we know are most pressing, especially things that I have said or failed to say that the audience finds most galling. So I just we'll get the hardest questions. And I'll probably anticipate some of those in my talk, but we'll store them up for each event and deal with them, in the second hour or two. So,
well, we'll do that. That's what we do for every episode here. So that shouldn't be too hard. All right. So there's no shortage of things to cover on this episode. So let's get into it. I want to start with the political violence that took place this past weekend in Minneapolis, where a state representative and her husband were murdered in their home, and a state senator and his wife were shot multiple times at their house and have thankfully survived. You got Trump, Josh Shapiro, two employees at the Israeli embassy, and you could throw in the United Healthcare CEO as well. What's going on with the explosion of political violence, and is this a new norm we should come to expect?
Well, I mean, it's obviously awful. It's also mimetic. We know that people find this kind of, the kind of notoriety that shooters get is somewhat contagious, right? So, we've had episodes like this before in our past. I mean, not for a very long time, but obviously, the late '60s was a time where we were sort of in free fall with respect to assassinations. I mean, it's awful. I think the thing that is, the only governor we have on it, apart from catching people and or providing great security so as to make it effectively impossible, is to shun any political rhetoric that directly inspires this kind of behavior. And unfortunately, both sides, not both sides equally, but both sides have at various points tipped over into, ways of speaking about their political opponents that have been totally irresponsible. And I would put Trump at the top of this list of people who has been...
Who's got the timer? How long did it take to bring Trump up there?
Well, I mean, it's just, but it's just the fact that here's somebody normalized political violence in several respects. I mean, his response to January 6th was a great act of normalization. You have people who are literally stabbing cops in the face with flagpoles, and they've been exonerated as American heroes. Yeah, all of that is part of what has pushed us to this moment, I think. So,
Well, I mean, I don't. Do you think we have to doge our the way that we treat these people instead of letting them become celebrities so quickly? Can't we just find these people that commit these heinous acts and disappear them very quickly?
We try to do that. I mean, it's sometimes better than others, but I mean, we did that effectively with, at least to my eye, we did that with the shooter for who tried to kill Trump. I mean, as evidenced by the fact that I can't even remember his name.
Yeah. Well, I think he was just killed right there on the spot. I think that's what happened.
Yeah, but like we haven't talked about him. He's not a martyr to any cause. In fact, we don't even, you know, I don't happen to know much about what his cause was. I mean, how much was mental illness and how much was an actual ideological motivation? We've been better in recent years about doing that, whether it's political violence or just violence. I mean, the Vegas shooter who still killed more people than any shooter in American history. Again, I've forgotten his name. I once knew it, but that was memory hold within like 72 hours of the occurrence. So I think we're getting better at it, but the way we are talking about our politics, I think is just, it's not reminiscent of any recent period in American history. I mean, we're so uncivil. I mean, this is of a piece with a U.S. senator being, you know, wrestled to the ground and handcuffed at a press conference for Kristi Noem, right? I mean, and the fact that his Republican colleagues in the Senate didn't immediately condemn that. In fact, some of them lined up on the other side and castigated him for some impropriety that they thought warranted his manhandling there. The thing that we're not recognizing is that civility is the last stop before violence, right? I mean, the civility is not just a nice to have, it's really a must have when you're talking about discussing politically polarizing issues.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to Alex Padilla and a little bit of that later, because I do think what he did, you know, perhaps had some impact on changing the course of events there. It seems that that's been walked back, but we'll get back to that in a bit. Or the ICE raids have been walked back because of the idea that apparently it's impacting the farming industry and the hotel industries, the hospitality industry.
Yeah, I wonder what those phone calls were like.
Well, no shit. I mean, what a dummy. Like, how obvious was that for him to say?
But also how dysfunctional is it that really what accomplished this change in policy undoubtedly were a bunch of rich friends of the president calling and saying, listen, you're fucking up my hotel business. This
had nothing to do with the humanity of it.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with wisdom or pragmatism or ethics or anything. It's just pure patronage. I mean, this is what is turning us into a banana republic. What Trump has done is he's put himself at the bottleneck of everything, and he's using both domestic and foreign policy to dole out favors and to friends and punish enemies. I mean, the thing that is so despicable about the Republicans now is that no one objects to this. That's what was amazing to see in the falling out with Elon. When, you know, you have all these people who, many of whom are welcoming Elon back into the fold. I mean, just desperate to patch up this marriage. And yet they're not acknowledging how corrosive it is to have a president who immediately goes to, if Elon supports any Democrats, there'll be extraordinary consequences, right? He's threatening him with what, a judicial investigation or a loss of contracts. He's using the levers of government power to say that his former friend shouldn't fund political opposition in this country. And everyone on the Republican side accepts that as somehow normal. This is, you know, authoritarian is the generic term for it. I mean, this is not remotely normal in American politics.
No. Well, you know, you talked about, while we're talking about Musk, in your recent Substack piece, you torched him. And this is something you and I were talking about earlier, that Musk has admitted that he went overboard with something that resembled, I guess, an apology on Twitter. But what he's saying here really matters. I mean, we shouldn't be quick to forget what he's basically saying. He's saying that he's either someone who has no morals, who just was happy to work with Trump, who was a rapist, a child rapist, and he was just fine because, well, he had shared interests, or he completely made up an insane lie about his friend. You know, someone who he loved as much as any man could love another. So either way, and the reason why I think it matters is because, according to your latest podcast, I think it was Daniel, or I forget his last name, you just spoke to about AI. One of these guys could very soon become the leader of the most powerful AI army in the world. And, you know, we should care about the character of these individuals.
Yeah, I don't know how we got here, but we seem to have, at least half of our society seems to think that we, the personal integrity of the most powerful people in our society doesn't matter, right? It's just like, it doesn't make, like, you can have the most self-interested, unethical people you can find, give them basically all the power human beings can have, and you could just expect everything to work fine. Now, it would be great to have systems, to have laws and institutions that were totally impervious to bad actors. I mean, that would be the dream. It's an unrealistic one. We don't have anything like that currently in the U.S. government. So it matters whether psychologically normal, at a minimum, psychologically normal people are in charge, right? And we just don't have that. We have narcissists and liars and confabulators and in certain cases, I think, mentally unstable people.
But I think a lot of times when you talk like that, people think you exaggerate. But right here, we saw Elon Musk, and we know.
Well, yeah, even on the president's account, he went crazy, right? So he's unstable. I mean, I think most people will admit that at a minimum, he's unstable.
But like, these are the two worst options.
But yes, those two interpretations of Elon's character. One, he was happy to collaborate with a person he knew to be a child rapist or an enabler of child rape. Or two, he was willing to claim that a person who is his favorite person on earth 10 minutes ago was a child rapist the moment their interests were no longer aligned. You pick your favorite interpretation of his character there, because that exhausts the possibilities.
But why isn't that being talked about more?
Because again, right of center, nobody cares about a person's character. They care about Hunter Biden's character, apparently, right? They care about whether Joe Biden's inner circle knew that he wasn't compos mentis and were letting the country, you know, have a somewhat vacant presidency or a presidency by committee, right? That strikes them as just adjacent to evil. But nothing on their own side matters, including, I mean, they were completely unfazed. The people who thought Elon was this absolutely impeccable omnibus genius, when he alleged that, you know, mark my words, Trump is a child rapist. In so many words, he alleged that. He doubled down on that tweet, said, you know, just flag this tweet, flag this post, come back to this post, mark this post, however he put it, you know, the truth will come out, right? He's claiming to have certain knowledge of Trump's criminal culpability, right? All these people who were up to that moment thought Elon could do no wrong. What did they think? Did any of them care? And these are also people, the irony is that these are also people who are disproportionately fixated on the problem of pedophilia. You know, half of them think there's a pedophile cult running the world. They certainly don't think Epstein killed himself. They think lots of powerful people are culpable for an immense cover-up there. And to hear that Elon knows and promises you that you will know soon, if you just watch this space, you soon will know that Trump is one of these sinister rapists or enablers of rapists, how many of them cared? Where were the Jack Posobiecs and the Charlie Kirks and the other grifters and confabulists, the Pizzagate dummies, the Mike Cernoviches? Where were they? Like, how did they not jump into that space one way or the other? Either Elon is lying and he's pure evil. He's smearing the president with the worst aspersion that can be summoned to a human mind. Or you trust Elon because, goddamn, he knows everything and he's been on the inside and he has all the data. And you sort of know anyway that Trump is like this. You know he was friends with Epstein for many, many years. You know he celebrated Epstein's sexual conquests and even named the fact that he likes his ladies young. He said that some people say that he likes beautiful women even more than I do. And he sure likes them young, right? That's practically verbatim, right? You know that in his 60s, probably, he was storming the dressing rooms of teenage girls at the Miss America pageant. You know that he's just right on the edge of doing this anyway, all by himself, right? And yet, who cared, right? This is, I mean, it's not even hypocrisy. It's just a complete vacancy of a moral sensibility, right of center now.
Well, they rightly care about lawlessness, too.
Oh, yeah.
Except for January 6th.
Only on one side, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So,
but I mean, but that I don't know. I mean, one can imagine it's going to normalize at some point. I think part of it is the characters we have in play. You know, I don't know that you can get a delusional cult under somebody like J.D. Vance, but I'm sure the Republicans will give it a good hard try.
All right, switching gears. Let's talk about Israel and Iran. Any early thoughts on that?
Well, it's not going to surprise you that I think that they are fighting our war in some respect. I mean, they're fighting their own war too, because a nuclear-armed Iran is definitely an existential concern for them. And if you doubt that, you just haven't been paying attention to what Iran has said for the last 20-plus years. I mean, the Iranian regime is explicitly a theocratic death cult. I mean, this is a jihadist regime of the Shiite variety that has had as its special focus for years and years the eradication of Israel. And so this is not a metaphor for anything. This is, once we get a bomb, we're going to turn Israel into glass, right? And I think the Israelis have to take that threat at face value. I mean, I think the lesson that the world should learn is that if you are going to be explicit in your genocidal aspirations, your neighbors, whoever you're targeting with these malicious hopes, your neighbors are justified in coming across your border and killing the principal bad actors. Words matter, right? And so if you're bluffing, you know, it's on you to not do that again, right? It's just, so I think it's completely warranted. I think, I mean, this is a commercial for what we should have done years ago, we being the United States.
And you think the Iranians would use a nuke? No doubt about it, if they got it?
Yeah. I mean, if they didn't use a nuke, if they just had them, I think they would do all the awful things they've been doing anyway. I mean, what's amazing is how deterred we, the Americans, have been by Iran in the absence of nukes, right? We've treated them for at least 15 years like they've had nukes, right? I mean, it's been inexplicable from my point of view. I mean, this is not a regime that we should have been this afraid of, as witnessed by the fact that Israel has just dismantled them and their proxies more or less all by themselves in the aftermath of October 7th, right? So Israel is showing us how you do this. And now the question is whether we should help them. I mean, they've done the hard part. They really have done the riskiest heavy lifting as far as I can tell. And now the question is, do we do the thing that only we can do, which is to bomb the most hardened structures that are still contain the enriching, you know, centrifuges? And that's being debated now in public and surely in private. And I guess there are reasons why not. I mean, it would be certainly provocative. This is war. You don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know how the regimes that claim to be allies with Iran would react. I mean, Russia and North Korea and China haven't done or said much of anything up to the present moment. And if we got involved with B-2 bombers dropping 30,000 pound bombs on Natanz and Fordo, I think there's some concern that the perception of all of this would change. But I think it really is on us to help, because it's not just Israel's war. I mean, really, we have been targeted by Iran for years and years. They've been killing Americans for years. They were killing us when we were in Iraq, right? I mean, whatever you think about that war, Iran was killing American soldiers, right? And we did precious little about it.
I mean, it seems to me that we're right around the corner. I mean, after taking out Hezbollah, basically removing Hamas, you got the Houthis out, Syria's collapsed. Iran's the last one. If they can get rid of the regime, and nobody wants this more than the Iranian people.
Well, I mean, be careful what you wish for moment, because one of the lessons we learned from the Arab Spring is that when you tear the lid off of these societies, the secular authoritarian lid on any of these societies gets removed, what happens in the resulting chaos? Well, any hope that what happens spontaneously is democracy and the norms of open societies, and you get, you know, women in miniskirts letting their hair down in the streets, that hasn't been borne out. Now, I think many people better informed than I am directly about the attitudes in Iranian society today are optimistic that Iran, unlike almost any other Islamist theocracy, is really, it's poised to return to the modern world. I mean, we're talking about probably a majority of the population that is just sick to death of theocracy. But that still has no guarantee that the jihadists wouldn't win in the end, right? I mean, what has happened is virtually every Muslim society that has been pitched into chaos by our meddling, you have the most energetic, most willing to kill and willing to die young men on the jihadist side who just, they don't even have to be a majority, but there are enough of them to cow everybody else and theocracy reasserts itself under conditions of brutal chaos.
Yeah, I know it seems like, we've done this, we did this in Iraq, we've probably done it a number of places, but it's almost like this is the last one, right? Like it really does feel to me like if Iran goes, with the relationships that we have now with the Saudis and other countries around Israel and America, that if you could take out the Iranian regime, who really is the bully and the instigator for so much of the chaos that takes place in the Middle East, they're gone. You could have a clear shot to peace in the Middle East again, and Lebanon or Beirut could be the...
Well, except you do have a lot of Sunni extremists in the world who have no love for the Iranian regime, but are also committed to various theocratic projects and terrorism, right? So it's not... The problem of jihadism is not going to go away if this special case of it gets solved, and even if it gets solved perfectly. I mean, you're just talking about, in the perfect case, you would have a Shiite, cosmopolitan, open society emerge in Iran. That's not going to solve the problem for 85% of the Muslim world, which is still this low simmer of jihadism and Islamism.
Right. So you're going to have pockets of that are still going to be there, and those could be rather large pockets. But I think as a country, if you have that, I mean, you do change the landscape of the Middle East potentially.
Well, you change the Middle East a lot, given what Iran has been doing over the years. But yeah, that's already been changed, right? Israel has done so much damage to Hamas and Hezbollah.
But that's my point. They're just one pin away.
Yeah, no, Iran has been the problem this whole time. Iran is, all of these other groups, including the Houthis, are proxies in large measure for Iran, right? And Iran... You certainly could say that Hamas and Hezbollah posed a quasi-existential threat to Israel. And that's not much of an exaggeration. But Iran, a nuclear-armed Iran, just unequivocally does, right? So this was always the problem that Israel had to deal with. And I think, it'll be very interesting to see what we do, whether we stay on the sidelines. I mean, obviously, we've been helping them insofar as we haven't been stopping them. We supply them arms. We've continued to supply them arms.
Well, but it's more than that, right? I mean, Trump has obviously been pretty vocally supportive. Now, I think your position on that might be, well, if things didn't go well, Trump would have been like, I don't know anything about that. And you may be right.
Well, he's still, as far as I can tell, he's still in that posture. He's going back and forth. He's getting pushed around by the America First people in his party, right? The Tucker Carlsons and presumably J.D. Vance, although I haven't heard the vice president say anything publicly, but half of MAGA wants nothing to do with a war in the Middle East or anywhere else, right? And so it's controversial. It's splitting of MAGA for Trump to go all in with Israel. Yeah, I would agree that he's been fairly supportive, but it's not clear to me that he was really riding shotgun on this kind of masterful deception where he was saying one thing about negotiation, but really meaning something else, and it was a conscious deception of the Iranians to provide cover for the plot.
That's really how deception works, isn't it? You don't really ever know.
Yeah, I think we eventually will know, but it's from what I can tell, it's much more a story of Trump's default is not. I mean, say what you want about Trump, he's not a warmonger, right? He's not. He's a belligerent person. He's very fast and far too fast to signal a willingness to use violence domestically, right? He's always adding fuel to the fire and raising the risk of violence domestically, political violence in particular. But as a matter of foreign policy, he's pretty dovish, right? And so throughout this whole period, his emphasis has been to avoid further conflict, all the while being more supportive of the Israelis than I think we could have expected a Kamala Harris administration to be. And if you're a single issue voter and all you care about is not getting in Israel's way when they have to fight necessary wars, it's understandable that you would be happy to have Trump in charge at the moment.
Yeah. For those of you who think that Sam has TDS, you can go back a few minutes and find a compliment in there.
It's not a backhanded one either. I mean, I think he has been good enough on this issue. But again, this is, I don't see any sign that he was playing 4D chess with this issue either. I think he's just not getting in Israel's way. And if this has gone terribly, if Israel's planes were all shot out of the sky, he would have been on Truth Social saying, I told them not to do anything. I told them that it was a bad idea.
Right. Netanyahu just has he's stubborn.
So yeah, you know, success has many fathers.
All right. I want to switch gears and talk about the deportations and the LA protests that took place last week. But in here, I want to get to the protest and what happened there, but I want to talk about the heartlessness of the deportations. And it's been gut-wrenching hearing the stories. Yeah, they came here illegally and that was wrong, but these people have made great contributions to society in all sorts of meaningful ways. And perhaps a silver lining here is that a majority of the Americans disapproved of this, which was great to see. And now the administration has been forced to change course. I believe, as I said before, Trump had made a comment about the hotels or the farm workers. And so he's also, by the way, while we're talking about some of the things he's backed down on, so that we do have we have an ability to raise our voices and push back on things. The tariffs, I think Abrego Garcia has come back. I don't know what happened, by the way. It feels like it's been 100 years ago, but what's going on? I haven't heard him mention Greenland, Panama in a while.
Yeah.
Where'd that go?
I bet that's coming back, but no, I haven't heard that in a while either.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, get some of your, I know you liked what Newsom had to say too. Maybe you want to share some thoughts on that or just how you felt about all of that transpired last week.
Well, so, I mean, first we should just acknowledge the obvious. It's totally possible to have a sane immigration policy, right? To acknowledge that we had a problem at the southern border, that we want defensible borders, that we want to know who's coming into the country, literally every single person, right? That we want no more illegal immigration, right? You could commit to all of that. That would be my position. It's been my position for as long as I ever had a position about immigration, going back decades. And also to acknowledge how dependent our economy has been on illegal immigration, how good most of the people are who have immigrated illegally and are just doing necessary jobs that most Americans don't want to do, right? It's like most of them are paying taxes. They're paying more into the economy than they take out of it. And they're, given how long we've let this go on for, especially in states like California, these people are integrated into our community every bit as much as people who are here legally. I mean, many of them, again, you have to think about the details here. Many of them have children, and even in some cases, grandchildren who are legal, right? So you're talking about families and extended families that have been here for decades doing necessary work. And it's always seemed to me that what you want is some process by which you can normalize their status, right? Close the border. Know who's coming into the country, only let who you want in from now on, but acknowledge what has already happened and create some path to legal status for the people who are here, all the while acknowledging that you don't want MS-13 gang members here or any other violent criminals or any other criminals, right? So find all the criminals. Everyone is for that. Nobody is saying that we want to maintain foreign gangs on American soil because of all the good work they're doing, you know, moving fentanyl, right? So we can connect all of those dots in a way that is sane, that is not producing chaos on our streets, it's not shattering families, causing people who are here legally to be so afraid of leaving their homes that they're not even going to work for fear that they're going to be mistaken for being here illegally and sent to some El Salvadorian gulag. So the fear that he has imposed on the streets of America, and I would point out in blue cities preferentially, the fear has not been a byproduct of his policy. It has been the policy, right? He has wanted to provoke the backlash that we've seen on our streets, and he's wanted to bring that to a crisis point so that he can demonstrate a use of force in what is ostensibly law enforcement, right? But which is in fact putting out a fire that he started, right? He is the arsonist who's also holding the fire hose. It was completely unnecessary, right? It's sadistic. And it's, you know, for those who are students of authoritarianism, it's part of the playbook that normalizes the state use of violence And one can only wonder if that's part of the motivation.
Yeah. So I just want to go back to that image that you talked about, families being ripped apart, because I hear some of the responses that people say, well, they're illegal. They shouldn't have come here in the first place. As though people, if you actually spend a few minutes talking to them, they don't really feel that way. I mean, no one lacks that much compassion. If you showed them the images of really what's happening, regardless if they came here illegally, and okay, maybe they shouldn't have done it that way. I just don't think people are making contact with what's really happening in those moments. And really, I mean, just imagine your family being ripped apart, regardless of what happened.
And again, imagine you just add the children of these people who are citizens. How do they want that problem solved, right? They shouldn't be here. They send them back to Mexico or Guatemala or wherever they came from. They have a 4-year-old that is an American citizen. They have an 18-year-old who is an American citizen. What should happen there, right? We're talking about, at a minimum, I don't know the numbers. It has to be millions of people in that situation, right?
Yeah, and I once saw Holman, I guess, say somewhere where, you know, we pull somebody over for a crime, we separate the family. This isn't the same thing. You know, that sounds good in a soundbite, but that's not separating the families here. Just think about why they're criminals for trying to get to this country for the things that we have.
And the reason it's so cynical is that we have maintained on our side the need for their labor for all these years, right? I mean, all the restaurants and the hotels and the farms and the people who hired, you know, nannies and gardeners and housekeepers, right? I mean, like at every level, our society is complicit in creating this black market for labor, right? And so it's indefensible. I mean, it's just and what's so frustrating about it is that there seems to be nothing that can be done. I mean, there was a period where in the run-up to the election and even after Trump won in November, where many people living in these states, like California, imagine that, okay, the state is not going to let the federal government just round up people. Well, we're not going to be complicit in this starkly unethical behavior of just, you know, rounding people up in elementary schools and the parking lots of hardware stores and supermarkets and hair salons. Like, there's no way that's going to happen on the streets of Los Angeles. I think Gavin Newsom said as much. Well, when push came to shove, it just proved that there's very little the state or the city or municipality can do not to collaborate with federal troops, right? Or the weaponization of DHS.
Can I ask you a question? When the federal troops come in, why do we accept the argument that they escalate things, right? If the car's on fire weren't enough for you to know it's time to go home and come back for another peaceful protest, when they start, when the troops show up, why do people, I mean, you're not coming out for that. You're going home for that. Why is that not the rational reaction?
Well, so, I mean, there's just two levels to it. One, okay, whenever there is civil unrest, however noble the purpose, there are always some bad actors who are going to join the party just to cause chaos, right? So, and I don't know how much that has happened in the current case. I mean, so it's not, part of it's a story of people being truly and justifiably outraged by the behavior of ICE and the federal government. And they've made mistakes, right? They've arrested people who are here just, you know, traveling as tourists, right? And separated parents from children in that kind of context, right? I mean, that's just, I mean, they've done stuff that has provoked a sense of real emergency in local communities. So it's understandable that you have people who are just at the limit of their patience and willing to express, you know, some, you know, public show of defiance. But then you have added to that people who just want to throw chunks of concrete at cops and burn Waymos just for the hell of it, right? Right. I mean, so this is just like out of the Joker comic book, right? But there are those characters in society. Yeah, there's no defense of that behavior. But what the Trump administration has knowingly provoked is the former, the outrage that is going to get people by the thousands and tens of thousands into the streets, which becomes the occasion for some percentage of people to misbehave so badly that the use of force, serious force on the part of cops, is not only justifiable, but necessary. Honestly, what he could want is some kind of Kent State moment where you have people gunned down by federal troops and, you know, either just you have a mistake on the part of cops, or you have the justified killing of violent lunatics, right? I mean, there are violent lunatics who are going to show up to every one of these protests, or virtually every
one. And what are the odds that one of these bricks hits a guy in the head whose parents are probably illegal, right? There's some number of people in the National Guard who are U.S. citizens whose parents might be illegal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying there's nothing. I have no judgment of the Marines or the National Guard or
no, I'm saying it's not their fault.
No, I mean, they've been given a bad order. And, the you know, I want the cops to stop all of the chaos, right? I mean, nobody should want to see cars burning in the streets of their city, right? That's not protest. I mean, first of all, even if you were just concerned about the optics and the political pragmatism of it, none of that serves the interests of people who don't like what the Trump administration is doing, right? The moment you start burning cars and looting Apple stores, which happened in Los Angeles, you're just proving Trump's spurious point, which is these people are savages. These Democrats-run cities are utopias for anarchists. The only people capable of restoring order are me and my friends, and that's what we're going to do. And look at all these Mexican flags flying, too. Let's get all these people out. They don't even like our country, right? So, I mean, the optics matter. And even if you were just concerned about optics, you would want totally peaceful, orderly protest that never tips over into a public display of violence or vandalism.
All right, well, there's more to talk about in that topic, but we can't do it now because it's time for everyone's favorite segment, the lightning round, rapid fire questions for you, Sam. So that means short answers, as somewhat shorter answers, so we can get through a lot of this stuff. All right, what is the probability of conducting free and fair elections in 2026 and 2028? And what's the probability of a third term for Trump? I heard Bannon say Trump was definitely running and will win. Thoughts?
I mean, I don't even know how to get my head around the claim there. I mean, it's just, I have to think the probability of elections in both cases is very high. And provided we have elections that deliver the Congress in 2026 to the Democrats, I think the probability is extremely high that 2028 will be normal, right? I'm not getting ready to move to Canada because I think we have lost our democracy. That's not where my head is at. But I think we are in the hands of people who don't care about democracy or the Constitution. That is all too obvious.
What is the criteria for moving out of the country? And you know, what country would you go to if it ever came to that?
That's a very hard question. But honestly, I can't say I haven't thought about it, right? I've thought that final question, like just where would one go if one were leaving the country? I've thought about that, right? And it's just obscene to have ever had those thoughts, right? It's just, it's completely insane that we're in this situation, and no one can pretend to have been put in that situation by the Biden administration. That's the asymmetry here. All the people who are whinging about Hunter Biden's laptop and Joe Biden having Alzheimer's or whatever he has, none of those people are thinking, I might literally have to move out of the country because we could lose our democracy.
I think plenty of them had their version of it. It may not be the same, to the same levels, but plenty of them
if they had it, it was scarcely a sane version. I mean, then it's,
well, it was a version of people saying, my daughters are in school with, you know, in sports that now are allowing transgender.
I complained about, I'm,
and they're wanting to move.
That's a very different motive for moving out of the country. I'm talking about, like,
I don't mean moving out of the country. They had to move. They were bothered. I think a lot of Americans, you're right. Yeah, maybe didn't say I'm leaving the country. They're saying,
as you know, as was I, when that was on the menu, I think I complained about it almost as much as anyone. Anyway, I'm hopeful that we have not lost our democracy, but I see lots of fires that need to be put out.
Okay. I want to just quickly comment. I enjoyed your conversation with Jordan Peterson. I know many in the audience hate when you talk to him, but I think some get that it's worth talking to him because he's got a huge audience. And obviously you're not going to change his mind. You're going to potentially change the minds of those in the audience, but you have a lot of requests, speaking of Jordan, from the audience for you to challenge your guests more. And so, you know, there was an opportunity when Jordan, you're talking and he mentioned putting his foot in his mouth. Why not say, well, regarding some of those things, are there any that you've ever wanted to walk back? You know, obviously we're sensitive to the clip game over here because we see what people do, but you may give him the opportunity to respectfully say, look, we disagree on some of these topics. And I know when you were talking to Jordan as well, you maybe mentioned the comments that others were making that you thought they had lost the plot, but you're sitting across from him. And I do think I know we talked about this in the last episode, there's a respectful way to disagree with people. Why not incorporate that a little bit more?
Well, a few things to clarify. One is I was talking to Jordan's audience, right? I was on Jordan's podcast. He wasn't on my podcast. And I went on his podcast to talk to his audience, right? Not to talk to my audience, right? I'm talking to my audience here. I was talking to his audience over there. And then the question is, what is important to say in that context, right? And I said a lot of things over the course of that hour and a half or whatever it was that I expected him and his audience to find very controversial and it's things that would make them uncomfortable, right? I went very hard against Trump and Elon and Rogan and lots of people who Jordan is with whom there's very little daylight between them and Jordan, at least daylight that I'm aware of, right? So like, I mean, he doesn't agree with Candace Owens apparently, but he was certainly on good terms with Candace up until very recently. And so when I pushed on all of that, he could have given me lots of resistance. He actually didn't, right? So it's like, I mean, it's the fact that there weren't fireworks wasn't a result of my not saying anything that I thought might be incendiary. It's just that he didn't push back on really any of it.
No, I understand. But there you're talking about Candace, or you're talking about Tucker or somebody. Why not walk in and say, Jordan, you know, again, sensitive to the clip game, but you'd made some comments, like, especially when he opened up the opportunity about putting his foot in his mouth. You'd made some comments in the past, and you know, maybe this is a place we can. I understand you, again, you were being controversial for his audience for other things, but why not for something that came out of his mouth specifically versus his association with people?
Well, I'm not even sure I know what those things are. I mean, again, so it's not, I haven't been consuming Jordan's output in recent years. This is one danger, I guess, in going on his show or anybody's show where I'm not really part of their audience, right? So like, I don't know, like he could have said 10 crazy things in the last 5 years that I'm unaware of, right?
Yeah, but this is the pushback. The audience wants to know, why not go in with three? Go in armed with a little bit of the homework and say, all right, if I want to talk to him.
I went in armed with the stuff I thought was important to talk about, right? Now, I don't know what I don't know, right? But I went in with, I felt that it was very important to get Jordan's audience to understand that they're out there in podcastistan listening to voices that are not functioning by normal journalistic or academic or intellectual norms and criteria, right? I mean, they're just, you know, so for me to say something starkly critical of Joe Rogan or any of our other friends in alternative media, and for me to trash Elon and Trump to Jordan's audience, you know, that probably, I didn't see the comments, but that probably went over like a lead balloon for most of that audience because they're in Trumpistan, right? I mean, that's not my audience.
But I got to give you the comments that you're going to get back from that, which is you explicitly said you didn't want to hear the crazy things he said on the last episode and that, you know, Griffin had a list. And I'm saying, rather than spend time on that and what you did or didn't do there, on a go-forward basis, is it possible that when you do go speak to people, that you could go in armed a little bit more with things that they had said?
Well, I should know enough to know that I don't want to talk to somebody, right? Like, there are people I wouldn't talk to because I know how crazy they are. Like, I wouldn't talk to Candace Owens. I wouldn't go on her show because I just know it would just, I mean, it might be a colorful war, but it's just pointless, right? It's not a real conversation. I don't feel that way about Jordan. Jordan is incredibly civil and, you know, within his own framework, I think he's really trying to figure stuff out and he's not a bad faith actor. I mean, there's many things we disagree about, but it's just not, I don't see it as my job to do that kind of homework on him. Again, it's like if it was top of mind, then I wouldn't have avoided it. It's like I wasn't trying to avoid controversy. I just didn't feel like my time was best spent looking for the skeletons in his closet or what my audience perceives to be skeletons and then going on his show and trying to shine a light on them.
Well, again, I don't think we see it that way, meaning it doesn't have to be fireworks. Nobody wants to see you pin him. I think just going in there with a few topics where you could say,
well, no, but what the actual question was why didn't I spend whatever it was 2 hours to watch him debate 20 atheists and have that not go well, and then to bring that up with him as an atheist who's even a better debater than the people he didn't do a good job with, right? And then really kind of ram those points home. Like, I didn't want to have an atheist versus religion debate with him because we've done that and I know how it goes.
Yeah, but I don't want you to ram those points home. I still think we might be talking past each other. I think there's just a pleasant debate on that. But going forward, we're going to make sure Griffin has a few things for you before you go in and talk to people in the future, and then you can decide what to do with that. Any thoughts on the sole survivor in the unfortunate plane crash last week, the guy that just sort of walked right out? And are you buying seat 11A going forward on all flights?
Yeah. I mean, obviously I actually haven't heard the extent of his injuries, but, obviously.
He walked out. I mean, who gives a shit what his injuries are? He walked out of that plane. Yeah. I don't know,
I mean, obviously he's incredibly lucky, but, luck is just that. It's luck, right? I mean, the idea that one of the favorite arrows in the atheist quiver. I mean, like every person who ever thanks God in the aftermath of some horrendous accident of that kind is communicating a very strange ethical point that's disguised. And there's no doubt it is, in fact, a heartfelt expression of gratitude. But in the center of that gratitude is a very strange ethical claim, which is God loved me more than all these other dead people, right? And God had the power to save me. Presumably, he had the power not to let the plane crash in the first place, right? I mean, whatever the cause of the plane crash was, a faulty wire or a distracted pilot or a bird strike, or whatever, it's invariably this tiny thing that would have actually been easier. If you're just thinking of the physics of it, it would have been easier to intervene at that point than to spare this guy who's being hurled through flaming wreckage at whatever, at that point, 200 miles an hour into buildings made of concrete and magically survives. I mean, the physics of that intervention has to be a lot worse than just fixing the fuse or the neurons in the pilot's brain so as to prevent the accident in the first place.
Well, Sam, you're clearly missing this. God got all those people together because he needed to solve their problems and they needed to die and they needed to get this guy here so he could experience that. I mean, there's no mistakes here. Yeah.
Then you just have to hear a few of the biographies of the people who died and then you realize that that doesn't work, But again, this is the tennis without the net that one continually sees in every cult, right? I mean, Trumpism, I've claimed as a cult and its reasoning functions along cultic principles and, sincere religious conviction has all the dynamics of cultish thinking. I mean, you're just not keeping logical score of anything. You're just asserting a feeling over a set of facts and connecting the dots in a way that seems to make sense when you just don't pay attention to everything else that's in plain view to everyone else that doesn't share this feeling of yours. And again, the feeling of gratitude is all too, the reasons to have this feeling of gratitude and have it be overwhelming of rational thought is all too obvious in the current case. I mean, it's a miracle this guy survived, clearly. But, I don't mean to attack him. I don't know that he said anything about God. I haven't heard what he said. He might have, but it's just very common in this case for people to imagine that they were singled out to be saved. And they're not, it's like the very next thought you should have is, what fucking invisible psychopath would be playing that game with your life, right?
And there was always a lighter version with sports too, when they they win something as though God were there to pick that team versus the other team.
God's into sports today. He's not solving the problems of all the people being bombed in Gaza or anywhere else who you ostensibly also care about. No, he was on the pitcher's mound for the last 15 minutes, that's what he cares about.
All right, well, speaking of dying, did you see this Prince William's friend who died after swallowing a fucking bee, which then triggered a fatal heart attack? That guy did not sit in seat 11A on the way out there. Did you see that?
I don't know any of the details apart from that. Yeah, it's just insane. I mean, there's a lot of ways to die and there's a lot of things to worry about. That was not on my list of concerns, but now I'll add it somewhere near slot 150 or 160.
Yeah. In your recent podcast about AI, I thought it was a great point where the guy talked about the world and when AI shows up, that maybe in the back of our minds, we all just expected it to look like the Jetsons or something, but it's just going to look like this.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting. And
also it's worth realizing that it's already happening to some degree. I mean, already people are filtering their hiring decisions against what can AI do right now. I mean, the jobs are drying up for anything that can be automated. There's no question it's already happening. So, and there's some indication of that in the data and just what was looking like for the job prospects for people graduating college now. So this is part of the vision of the world looks the same, except the bottom rung of the ladder for white collar work is starting to get more or less invisible. And, you know, people looking for jobs of that sort, you know, the very, very highly qualified people, people who got an expensive education so as to qualify for those sorts of jobs, they're not finding a handhold for their first gig.
Did that that conversation change anything in terms of your concerns, or are you still in the same position?
No, I think it's the same. I mean, it's of a piece with many conversations that are happening on other podcasts and other in other media properties. I mean, you have very serious people like, you know, Geoffrey Hinton, who is, you know, one of the father who won the Nobel Prize for this work that gave us LLMs. You know, in his case, one wonders why it took him so long to be worried. I mean, he's crossed from being not at all worried and inventing the technology and being a staunch defender of it to somebody who's now about as alarmist as, I mean, he's not quite over with Eliezer Yudkowsky, but he's close. I mean, he's just, this is existential, and it's a kind of a coin toss as to whether or not we're going to solve this problem.
Yeah, can you have somebody on the podcast who disagrees with you there? Have you had somebody disagrees on AI? I don't know.
Yeah, oh yeah, I've had David Deutsch, and I had him fairly recently. I had Mark Andreessen. I had, I debated Rodney Brooks in public. That wasn't recorded as far as I know. There's been a few other people on the podcast. I mean, Steven Pinker, when we talked about this at the live event that got recorded, it's on a podcast, didn't agree with any of that. There's a lot of people who don't think the alignment concern, I mean, so they're, to remind everybody, there's two concerns here. One is the human misuse of AI, and that has many variants. And the other is unaligned AI, AI that gets away from us, that starts doing its own thing, and we can no longer control it, despite our best intentions. More or less everyone acknowledges the first species of problem. There are many people, you know, fewer people now, but there are still many people who don't acknowledge the second problem. And I mean, I think we have enough to worry about with the first problem. The problem of bad people using AI for whatever their malicious purpose is, that's an enormous problem. I mean, there's no question.
Sam, how often do you perform meta meditations directed at Trump and or Elon? Your fans are pretty fun.
Well, I can say not never. Not never.
Not never?
No, not never, no.
Okay, that's really nice. Well, it might surprise some people.
Perhaps I should do more. But I mean, the thing is, people are confused about the nature of my derangement, if in fact you think it's a derangement. It's not personal, right? It's not emotional in the sense that I hate the guy and want his projects to fail because I hate him. It's just not that. I mean, insofar as he does anything good, I can acknowledge it and I'm grateful for it, right? It's like, it's the fact that he is doing so many things that are obviously bad and obviously corrosive of our larger political culture. And again, if it were a computer virus that was doing these things, I would have the same feeling. I would be talking about the danger of this virus and how worried we have to be about this virus. And God, can't somebody find a solution to this virus, right? This, yet again, the virus is fucking up the media or fucking up our government's policy. Or I mean, it's just, to come back to the one compliment I paid him in this conversation, there's no question that he has been a better than benign influence on Israel's current predicament. I mean, he could be much better than he's been. He could be much clear. He could speak with actual moral force about the conflict that Israel is in. He could be not compromised by his own obvious self-interest in grifting the rest of the Gulf and, you know, flying to Qatar, you know, on his first trip to the Middle East and not to Israel, just so he can receive a $400 million plane and billions in cryptocurrency commitments and all that, right? I mean, like, he's so compromised there. And he clearly has, I'm not saying he doesn't see the problem for Israel with a nuclear-armed Iran, and he's not on the right side of that. He seems to be, but he's the bright, shiny object of rich people in the Gulf who might give him a resort deal is obviously taking up more of his bandwidth, right? So it's, that part is terrible and a desecration of our country, really. I mean, it's just mortifying, but there is every reason to believe that Kamala Harris would have been terrible vis-a-vis Israel as president, right? Now, existentially terrible? No, I don't think so. But in terms of communicating and understanding of Israel's actual predicament and the zero-sum contest between, you know, Western democracies and open societies and Islamist theocracies, right? She would have been captured by woke imbeciles all day long, one fears, one reasonably fears. Obviously, I can't know that for sure, but I would have bet a lot on that. It's Trump comes out very good in that comparison.
I want to talk about one more good thing about Trump, and this certainly would not have happened in a Harris presidency. Have you signed up yet for Trump Mobile?
No.
Have you seen that?
No, I just heard about that before we came on. So yeah, I'm sure that's as insane as it sounds, but you know, who knows?
As awful as it is, I can't help my marketing mind. I have a great pitch for them. You ready? In the first year, at random every day, one of their customers gets a call from the president.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That would be huge.
That's great. Oh yeah.
God, should we invest?
Yeah. Just take him 5 minutes. He loves that apparently for this sort of thing. So
he's great at that. He's great. He'd love that.
Oh yeah. And they could broadcast it on Truth Social, proving that it happens every day. Yeah.
You just added something even better.
So it would be good for that business and for Truth Social.
Unbelievable. Yeah. If anyone has any relationships there, please let us know. We'd like to be a part of it.
Four people in my audience, still in my audience, who have some relationship with the
It's fucking awful, regime. But if we can get rich, I mean, we know. All right. Last question here, because we got to get going. Anything you'd wished that you'd learned earlier in life?
Yeah. I think this is probably a point I've made long ago when I was just publishing books, but I should have understood much earlier that my real purpose in writing and now with podcasts and everything else I'm doing is to actually communicate ideas to people, right? So it's not a private, even though it seemed like a private, you know, solitary project to be, especially writing. I mean, podcasting doesn't seem that way so much, but when you're taking years to write a book, you can lose sight of the fact that what your goal really is not to write necessarily the perfect book. It's to actually find an outlet to the world so that you can have an ongoing conversation with an audience. I was very slow to realize that, and I did lots of impractical things and wrote in impractical ways and sought to publish in ways that were bound to be frustrated until I realized that you just have to actually ship something and start the conversation, right? So I should have been writing articles, in practical terms, long before I tried to write the great American novel or tried to write a magnum opus as a book. I should have been publishing articles just to start that process, right? I should have found an outlet much earlier. And you know, this was before blogs, or certainly before I knew about blogs. So it's obvious, it's all, you know, in the age of Substack, it's only become much easier to jump online and start to find your outlet and start the conversation. But I was very slow to realize that, and that's in retrospect, that's something I don't have many regrets, but I do regret that I should have started the process earlier.
Okay, I want to thank everyone again who submitted topics and comments on Substack. We really appreciate it. And Sam, why don't we go meet up for some lunch somewhere?
Let's do it. Thanks again.
You got it. Thank you. I'll give you a call.